Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. For weeks, the threat of a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine has steadily dominated headlines. As of now, Russia has three sides of Ukraine surrounded and has amassed more than 100,000 troops at the Ukrainian border. American intelligence believes an attack could happen any day. Ukraine is far away, and according to a new poll by the Morning Consult, only about one in three Americans can identify it on a map. But more than 30,000 of our neighbors in the Commonwealth identified as Ukrainian as of 2016. It is their families on that map. The threat is not abstract for them, and we want to connect with that today. In a few minutes, we will speak with a member of the local Ukrainian community. But first, to fully appreciate her perspective, let's get a clearer sense of where we are right now and how we got here. To help us do that, we are joined by Emily Channel Justice, director of the Temerty Contemporary Ukraine Program at the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute. Emily, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, let me check that summary. Near war, surrounded on three sides, massive civilian casualties if that happens. Is that a fair assessment of the situation?
That is a fair assessment of the situation, unfortunately.
And how did we get here, Emily? Obviously the history between Russia and Ukraine goes back centuries, but maybe outline this latest buildup of tensions for us and what this crisis is stemming from.
Well, this really goes back to 2013 and 2014 when Ukrainians came out to the streets in support of Ukraine's Western direction and against the pro-Russian president at the time, Viktor Yanukovych. This was a protest movement that was known as Euromaidan, and it resulted in the election of a pro-democratic, Western-looking president and Ukraine really going on the path toward Europe. And in response, Russian President Vladimir Putin illegally annexed the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. And then after that, Ukrainian separatists or pro-Russian separatists in eastern parts of Ukraine.
Okay, so we are losing Emily.
That they would
Emily, I'm going to have you just hang on just a second. We are losing you. So while we make sure we've got your sound back, I'm just going to summarize for listeners what we just heard from you while we're getting your sound back clear. So this latest conflict dates back to the 2013-2014 era when Ukraine essentially adopted a more Western-facing leadership and approach, but there were Russian separatists inside Ukraine after Ukraine annexed Crimea who wanted to go in a different direction. I think we're trying to get Emily back now. Emily, do we have you?
Yes, so sorry about that.
No problem. So I was going to do that summarizing anyway, so just pick up from there.
Yeah, so basically this conflict has been going on since 2014, and it was in response to Ukraine's initial push to move toward Europe. And over the course of the past 8 years since that conflict broke out, there's been kind of parts hot and cold. There's been increases in tensions and then pulling back, increases of Russian troops pulling back, cyber attacks, all these sorts of hybrid warfare tactics have been going on for the past 8 years. So what's happening now is a new and bigger escalation than we've seen in the past 8 years. But it is sort of part and parcel of the same tactics that we have seen develop over the past 8 years. And so that's why you see the Ukrainian government kind of responding by saying, you know, everybody calm down.
So, you know, so it's part and parcel. You say it's been 8 years, and yet we're here at this moment, not sometime in 2019 or sometime in 2020. So what got us to this moment? And is this in any way, and I am not belittling 2013, 2014 with this question, is this in any way more threatening or more dangerous on a global scale than the situation we found ourselves in before?
It seems to me that it is to some extent, because Vladimir Putin has made several different kinds of efforts to solidify his own power, to be sure of the legacy that he's going to leave in Russia. And he seems to be acting on that right now by responding with such aggression that we haven't seen in the past 8 years. you know, the whole discussion around NATO, as I mentioned before, the discussion in 2013, 2014 was about Europe and the European Union. Today, the discussion is about NATO, which, of course, is a military alliance that would actually...
Of European countries.
Right. And the U.S. and Canada, with the U.S. being, of course, you know, the biggest contributor. So that kind of tension that's organized around a military response to Russian aggression, I think, is what's maybe prompting a different response.
Okay. So in the simplest terms possible for people who know nothing about the region, what is this about for Russia and what is this about for Ukraine?
Well, you know, for Ukraine, this is about existing. This is about a country that exists in the world, that has defined what it wants to be in the world, that's a democracy. It wants to be a democracy. That's what it's about. And for Russia, frankly, it's about the same thing. It's about to accept that Ukraine is a different country, which he's written an entire essay last summer about how Ukraine is not a different country. Ukrainians aren't different from Russians. And so in that way, it's about Putin for the world order. And the view, you know, Putin's vision of the world is about autocracy. It's about repressing rights. It's about his legacy and nothing more. And you know, he just can't really accept that Ukraine would choose a different path because he doesn't think it exists.
Okay, I appreciate that. That's Emily Channel Justice. She is the director of the Temerty Contemporary Ukraine Program at the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute. Emily, appreciate the bit of a primer for us today. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, so now let's turn to that local voice. Olga Lisovska is a Ukrainian soprano who immigrated to the U.S. in the late 1990s. She's now based in Newton, Massachusetts, and is founder of the nonprofit organization Music Arts and Fashion Productions and a managing partner of Sky International Center. Olga, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Olga, how have you been these last couple of weeks? How are you feeling?
Very stressed out, to tell you the truth, because my family is still there. My mom is stuck now in Kyiv. She's an American resident, you know, permanent resident, and a Ukrainian citizen. And she went back home to just take care of a few things that she needed to do. And, you know, the COVID, unfortunately, there in Ukraine is not, it's still going strong. Here in Newton, we are lifting the mask mandate next week, thank God. But there are still many regions that have elevated risk levels. So she got stuck due to COVID, and now she's stuck due to no-fly zone over Ukraine. So I'm not doing too great, you know, too happy.
I'm so sorry to hear that. President Biden has been encouraging Americans in Ukraine to get out. You're telling me that even if she wanted to, she can't.
She can't. Yes, yes. It appears that, you know, many flights have been canceled by many, you know, airlines. And of course, you know, she has my brother there. Her son is also there, so she wouldn't want to leave him there. And I have a lot of family. I have a young nephew with whom she's very close, who is her grandson. And of course, I have a lot of family in the south of Ukraine. So if she were to leave now by herself, even if she did find a way, she doesn't want to leave the loved ones behind.
Olga, I don't want to sort of be voyeuristic about your fears, but I do want to ask you, what are you worried about happening?
I want to keep that private because I don't even want to say things out loud. I still have hope that everything's going to work out. I still have hope for the diplomacy, that we're very grateful to the United States for stepping up and for educating the people, the public in the United States about our country, about Ukraine's plight for democracy. So I'm still very, very hopeful.
Are you able to talk with your mother, your brother, other family members? Are you in regular contact with them?
Yes, I've been speaking with them several times a day on Messenger, Facebook, you know, Viber, all of the, you know, WhatsApp, all of the technology things are still functioning, thank God. And they've been, you know, their mood actually has been up till today. You know, today seems to be a very pivotal day for Ukraine. But up till today, they've been kind of very hopeful and saying nothing's going to happen. It's all going to play out. And it's just Putin playing his part and flexing his muscle and trying to threaten everybody, you know, Ukraine and the Western Europe. However, as of today, when I spoke with my mom, there is a change, of course, in her tone of voice. She is considering something like driving, you know, taking all the family and getting into a car and driving west, you know, to Western Ukraine, even though we don't have any family there. If something happens, you know, God forbid, they would be on their way to escape.
Are you feeling seen and heard and supported by your community here? I know you're based in Newton, but by the greater Boston community, are we as a community hearing and understanding and responding as you want and need?
Absolutely. I have so many friends, Ukrainians and internationals and Americans, and they are all reaching out to me. They're asking how they can help and, of course, expressing their feelings. And Ukrainian diaspora here is organizing a special event. I think it's coming this Sunday, where we're going to have motorcade with flags and Ukrainian insignia to raise the awareness about this situation. So everybody's coming together, and I feel blessed to be part of this community.
You said earlier that today is a pivotal day. I'm assuming you're referring to the fact that, you know, the Biden administration is briefing senators today. There's been a warning by U.S. intelligence that an attack could be imminent, although it's not quite clear yet. Is there something else you're referring to, or is that what you mean when you say today is pivotal?
Well, today's pivotal day is because finally the people in government, they are saying that it is possible, that the war is possible, and they are laying out the plans, evacuation plans. So it's all of a sudden it got real for the citizens of Kyiv and Ukraine, because before that there was no talk about war and no talk about any evacuation sites or bomb shelters. So I was talking to my mom and I said, do you even know where the closest bomb shelter is? You know, do you know where to run to if anything were to happen? And she kind of dismisses it. You know, she says, oh, I'm sure everything's going to be okay. But I feel in her voice, you know, that it's starting to become something more, you know. Mm.
You said that you are getting good support. If somebody does want to support, you know, our Ukrainian neighbors now, how can people help? How can people in this area help right now?
Well, our Congressman Jake Auchincloss, he reached out to our community Ukrainian constituents, and we formed a delegation. On Friday, we went and we spoke with him. So we feel that our voices are heard. And please reach out to us and see how we can explain what Ukraine is, because we want to make sure that people of the United States, they realize that Ukraine is not part of Russia unless... I mean, at least that's what Putin wants people to believe. You know, he wants to believe that Ukraine is just part of Russia, but it is not. It has totally different nation, totally different country, totally different culture and history, and we're proud of it.
So, Olga, you're a singer, and I think you brought part of a song to share, a traditional Ukrainian song to share for us, something that's maybe brought you some comfort in this uncertain time.
Yes, correct. When I was asked to be part of this interview and Franziska asked me if I wanted to sing something, I asked my Ukrainian people, what should I sing? And they all were unanimous. They said, please sing the prayer for Ukraine, because it has these beautiful words of asking God for protection, prosperity, happiness, and many wonderful years of life.
Please go ahead.
Боже великий єдиний, нам Україну храни, волі світу промінь. просвіти, в чистій любові до краю, ти нас, Боже, зрости. Дай йому волю, дай йому долю, дай доброго світу. Щастя дай, Боже, народу, і мная, мная.
Olga, that was beautiful. Olga Lisovska is a Ukrainian soprano from Newton, Massachusetts. She's also the founder of the nonprofit organization Music, Arts, and Fashion Productions and a managing partner of Sky International Center. Thank you for sharing your story with us. We will be thinking of you.
Thank you.
For a lot of people, journalism looks like this.
We have the goods. We don't have any competition. There's dozens of stories in here. The Times has barely scratched the surface. We have 10 hours till the deadline, so we dig in.
Tom Hanks there playing Ben Bradley, longtime executive editor of The Washington Post, in the 2017 movie The Post about the paper's reporting on the leaked Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers weren't publicly released until 2011, but they contained vital information about the workings of the government, and that's why we have public record laws, the ability for private citizens and journalists to see documents that show what our government is doing. Here's the thing. Massachusetts is one of the two least transparent states in the country when it comes to public records. Right now, the governor, for example, is exempt from the public records law. If someone requests records from that office, administration doesn't have to hand them over. A new bill introduced by Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin aims to change that. And we want to really dive into this. With us, Todd Wallach, deputy managing editor here at WBUR, who sued the state for records while a reporter with the Boston Globe's investigative team, Spotlight, and Jeff Foster, executive director at Common Cause Massachusetts. Todd, welcome.
Great to be here in the studio.
Great to have you, Todd, in the studio. Yay. Jeff, you're remote, but you are just as welcome.
Hey, Tiziana. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Jeff, I'm actually going to start with you. What is an example of information that a citizen might want public, and it isn't right now? First thing that comes to mind for me is maybe who's the governor meeting with, for example.
Yeah, so first, I just want to start by saying we are so excited to see this bill being filed. It's been a long, long time coming here in Massachusetts. Common Cause Massachusetts has been working for decades to try to make our government more accessible, more transparent. So we're really excited to see this. I mean, there's a lot that happens in government, especially in the governor's office, that would be helpful for the public to be able to understand more, right? And the existing public records law spells it out for us. Any material like books, papers, maps, recorded tapes, statistic tabulations, anything really that's being used to decide and eventually implement policies that impact all of our lives. And it'd be really helpful and good for democracy for the public to know a little bit more about what's being considered.
So, Todd, what kind of information might people want that they can't get right now? And who can't they get it from in Massachusetts that they could in some other state?
Yeah, well, Massachusetts has a lot of holes in the public records law. We're the only state where the governor's office, the legislature, the judiciary all claim to be completely exempt from the public records law. So any records that they have, they say it's up to them to decide whether to provide them to journalists, citizens, or anybody else who asks.
So what does that cost us? What can't we pay attention to and hold our legislators or our elected officials accountable for because we can't get that information, Todd?
Well, it's any records you can imagine. So you mentioned calendars. So, I mean, think of, you know, all the people that the governor and other officials are meeting with. But it goes beyond that. I mean, it could be what types of complaints are coming about that office. Are they signing secret deals? Even just looking at their credit card records with other officers, records of how the government is spending their money is public. But with these three arms of government, they claim to be completely exempt from the public records law.
And Jeff, that is not the case most other places, correct?
Right. Actually, Massachusetts is one of the few remaining states to still offer blanket exemptions like that. And again, as Todd mentioned, you know, it goes beyond the governor's office, right? We're hearing that the legislature and the judiciary are also claiming the ability to have blanket exemptions. And, you know, a lot of confusion, actually, especially around the governor's office, comes from the 1997 lawsuit Lambert v. Judicial Nominating Council, which was very narrow in its scope. But ever since that ruling, we've seen every governor, Democrat and Republican here in Massachusetts, reference the Lambert decision in their blanket exemption. And so we know, while, you know, originally it's not clear that the legislature, when they drafted this law, had ever intended to create that blanket exemption in the first place. So again, we're excited to see this bill being filed.
So Todd, as I understand it, Secretary Galvin's bill applies the public records law to the governor's office. I've read some analysis that suggests that it doesn't for the judiciary and the legislature to make it more palatable to get something signed and make a step forward. What's your take on that?
Well, there certainly have been efforts in the past to broaden the public records law to make it clear that it covers the legislature as well. And those efforts have gone nowhere. So this is a narrower effort. It's gotten people talking. It is possible that Secretary Galvin filed it with the hopes that maybe this would have more possibility of getting passed than a broader one that also included the legislature.
So I also you talked about that narrower focus, Todd. I understand, Jeff, that at the city level, we're seeing more of this too. And you know, this is on my mind because, you know, we're all in the information business. So for us, it makes total sense. I got to be able to get a hold of these records. We need to hold government accountable. You know, if I'm sitting at my kitchen table and I'm thinking about the things I'm dealing with every day, Jeff, this may not be front and center on my mind. So I thought Framingham was an interesting example. We spoke with Framingham City Councilor John Stefanini, who authored an ordinance in the city last year to increase transparency, including amending how the city responds to public records requests. He says he's in favor of opening up the state's public records law. Here he is.
It is a challenge to, you know, operate in a fishbowl. But it is that fishbowl that genuinely improves the process and the product.
So, Jeff, I'm going to be devil's advocate a little bit here. Most people aren't paying that close attention and don't know about when the governor's meeting with somebody and it doesn't affect their daily lives. Why are we entitled to elected officials operating in a fishbowl? And why is it important for some to make sure that happens, even if we can't all pay attention that way every day?
Yeah, I think this is why there's such an institutional importance behind media and what we do here at Common Cause Massachusetts and other good government watchdog groups, is that voters count on us and trust us for information so that they can become as informed as they need to be when it comes to voting. And so, yeah, they may not be tuned in every day into the nuts and bolts of this, but it's really important that when they turn to their trusted sources for information to become informed citizens, that we're able to provide them with the strongest information possible.
And Todd, this gets silly hard sometimes, doesn't it? To actually get information that you want or need as a journalist or as a, you know, a representative of the public interest from departments that aren't covered under the public records law?
Yeah, absolutely. Because when I filed requests with the courts and the governor's office, sometimes they provide me information. And other times they say, sorry, we're not going to, and we're not covered by the public records law, so there's nothing you can do about it.
Does there seem to be any rhyme or reason? Like, do you know, oh, I'm never going to get this, they're always going to say yes to this, or is it capricious?
It varies a lot. Part of it depends on whether it's in their public interest, whether it's in their personal interest to get information out. So, you know, if there are records that the governor wants people to see, the governor has an interest in doing that. If they're embarrassing records, the agencies are more likely to withhold them.
So, Jeff, Governor Baker's not running again, and Attorney General Maura Healey, who actually upheld this 1997 finding that the governor's not covered under the public records law, is running for governor. I know she has said that she's actually in favor of greater transparency. open race this year. In general, do we have hope that whoever gets elected is going to want to do things differently? And does the fact that the governor's not going to be the one mean that if this gets to his desk before the election, he might be more likely to sign it? I know I'm speculating all over the place here, Jeff, but speculate with me.
Yeah, I mean, on principle, it's time. It's time to get something like this done here for Massachusetts. But I do think the political landscape and the moment we're in as a country really invites this and other related reforms. We're really excited to see that. I know many of the candidates who are running for governor have been willing to support some sort of a change like this to the public records law. We'd be really optimistic to see the legislature and governor get something done.
So, Todd, when I taught in social work, sometimes I would teach about the Flint water crisis and how our systems do or don't support people who are marginalized and vulnerable. Of course, lead in the water there in vulnerable communities. Michigan is similar to Massachusetts in terms of not having good transparency laws. And people were not able to get information that they needed about the governor's actions, for example, in that case. Is that an extreme example, or is that the kind of stuff that happens and that you can't find out about when public record laws are less transparent?
Well, it's a very notable example. But there's certainly been other examples of records that are of interest when it comes to governors and other powerful officials. For instance, the records of the recording that former President Trump had with the Secretary of State in Georgia. Was very important records. And if that type of conversation happened with the governor in Massachusetts, those records would not be subject to the public records law. Or look at all the allegations against the former governor in New York, both with sexual harassment and misusing the office with people working on his book. Those types of records would not be subject to the public records law in Massachusetts because the governor's office claims to be completely exempt.
So, Jeff, you have said the time is now. We've just looked at the legislation. It only covers the governor, what Secretary Galvin is proposing. Is this the kind of thing that someday maybe it's a ballot initiative? Can we explain and get people interested on the everyday street about this? Could it be something swept up in a ballot initiative?
Whether we can or can't, we should try. And I will say right now, I'd say it's a little early on a ballot initiative. I think it's really important for folks to weigh in, to let their state legislators know that they think this is the time to ensure that the governor's office is explicitly named in our public records law. And I do want to just add one thing. I think it's really important to note because, as the conversation and likely a debate plays out around this, there are already normal exclusions built into the public records law now, right? So things like personnel information or health information that's otherwise not able to be released publicly, that's already built into the public records law. And so those normal exclusions would apply still to the governor. But as we've already heard from Todd and earlier in the discussion, there's just so much more to be gained by the public here. But we're hopeful for the bill and we'll follow it along the process and see what needs to happen.
All right. That is Jeff Foster, Executive Director at Common Cause Massachusetts. Also with us, Todd Wallach, Deputy Managing Editor right here at WBUR, who sued the state for records while a reporter with the Boston Globe's investigative team Spotlight. Todd, thanks.
Thank you.
And Jeff, thanks to you too.
Thanks, Tatiana.
Fashion Week in New York. What do you picture? Glamour, models, designers from around the world. But what about a local from Springfield who first spent 19 years developing skills working at The Gap? That is the true story of Justin Haynes, whose custom designs really have taken the fashion world by storm. Studied in Singapore, Milan, Ukraine, showed in Paris and New York, but he built his company in Springfield, launched his brand, Justin H., at the Enfield Square Mall. And he joins us now, fresh off of New York Fashion Week. Justin, welcome to Radio Boston and congratulations on your success.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So I feel like we should start by asking, how was Fashion Week?
Fashion Week is still going on, but this weekend was absolutely amazing. I can't really put it into words. I think it actually went far past my expectations. I think this is one of my better Fashion Weeks, to be honest.
What is success in a fashion week for a designer, Justin, and why was this one so particularly successful for you?
Well, first, coming off of a pandemic, and we're still in a pandemic, but being able to show live with the audience was a huge change. And it was just like a breath of fresh air to be able to actually see people see your clothing, see your work in person. A success story for New York Fashion Week is getting down that runway with zero flaws, models coming down, and just making sure that, you know, everything is 100%. And that's what made a successful show. Like, I had zero flaws. There was no music errors. All my video was intact. I just think everything was just right in line.
I feel like it's safe to say that now. We can't jinx you because it already happened. So I do want to ask you, growing up in Springfield, you know, we are not necessarily known in Massachusetts for our fashion chops. You spent 19 years in retail at The Gap. Back then, in those years, did you think this was where you'd be? Was this always the plan?
It was a dream. I didn't think I would get here this quick. Let me say that. I think, you know, The Gap and being at The Gap as long as I was definitely gave me the business knowledge that I needed. But I did not think that, you know, it was possible for me to remain in Springfield, to remain in Massachusetts, and still be able to be known in New York and various places. So, no, it was a dream, but I didn't think it would happen to me.
And is it because you willed it, this part about it's not possible, you didn't think to stay in Springfield and be showing all over the world? Were you wrong that it's just not that hard? Or my sense is that it's you. You're the reason that's been possible.
Yeah, and I have to say, I know down to my city or my state, they weren't that receptive to fashion, and my particular fashion when I started, and some still aren't now. They're definitely there now because of the accolades that I received in New York and, you know, Paris and Milan. So I have to say, I put the work in, you know, thank God that he allowed me to do that. But it wasn't this area. This area didn't push me, because if I had just stayed in my corner and not, you know, put myself out there and not make my presence known to the industry makers, I would still be probably somewhere working part time at The Gap right now.
So who did show up for you early?
I would have to say my mentors, my mom, my dad, especially God did. But one person that actually helped me get to this point, was my mentor, Miss Jessie, outside of my mom. Miss Jessie actually taught me everything that I know about sewing. She set me down for 6 months in her basement every day, morning to night. And I was able to actually learn how to pattern cut, how to sew, how to make my blocks, my circles. She taught me everything I know. Going to now, I owe a lot of my success to Melissa Shea, who was one of the industry makers of New York Fashion Week, and she does all of the networking. She really put me in a place to be seen, and I, you know, I owe her that that respect.
How old were you when Miss Jessie taught you how to sew, and how did you know her?
Well, Miss Jessie she went to my church when I was growing up. So she was the one, the fashionista I was looking up to in church, you know. I started my brand when I was 29. So it had to be about 28, 29 when she was teaching me how to sew. And she was just that recognizable person that sewed everything she had. And for her to even want to take me under her wing and show me everything she knows is absolutely amazing. She tells everybody now I sew better than her.
So we are talking to Springfield-based Justin Haynes, fashion designer straight off the runway of Fashion Week in New York. Happy to have you on the show, Justin. A little earlier in our conversation, you said, listen, early on, the region, the state, not necessarily ready to support you or your fashion. So let's talk a little bit about what your fashion is. Tell me about the designs that you just showed over the weekend.
Well, what I showed over the weekend is I just released a new label the beginning of the year. Actually, it was a little earlier before the year actually leaked out, before it was supposed to. This was actually supposed to be the launch, but I started a new luxury label called Onyx, which is the luxury side of Justin H, where it's all of the basics, the tans, the whites, the blacks, the denims, and it's all with leathers and luxury denim, you know, and some luxury cotton. So that's what I showed at New York Fashion Week. This was supposed to be the original launch. So I showed my new label, Onyx.
And what was maybe your favorite piece that you put on the runway?
this time. Favorite piece, I'm biased. I love all of my clothing, but my favorite piece was my moto jacket. It was a leather moto jacket, and I put cheetah fur inside. So it was like a moto kind of motorcycle jacket. And I put cheetah print fur inside, and everybody went crazy over it. So that was my favorite piece.
And is all of your work custom, Justin? Like, can anybody go buy that jacket, or do they have to know you and pay you to make one special?
Well, see, what I don't do is I'm ready to wear. So if I make it, it's ready to go, and it's that one piece. So that piece is still available. However, I don't duplicate. I like to keep my models unique and one of a kind, and I consider all of my customers' models because they go out and they show the world is their runway. So I keep them all unique and one of a kind. So anyone can purchase the coat. It's just when you see that, that'll be the only one.
So, you know, that is a pretty transformational view of modeling and beauty, Justin, to say that whoever purchases your clothing, when they wear it out in the world, they are models. I know you know the fashion industry has come under great criticism, especially in the last several years, about really limited and uninclusive definitions of what beauty is. How do you think about and respond to that? How are you thinking about what beauty is, and what are you doing with that in your work?
My response to that is beauty is what you make it. I tell everybody that. If you believe that you're beautiful, if you believe that it's beautiful, if you believe that it's great, it is great. You know, I don't think any one of us can define that. That comes with inner being. That comes with your self-confidence. How I'm changing the game in that is I'm trying to make fashion available for everyday life. So that means regardless of your size, your race, your height, your weight, regardless of what it is and who you are, I'm making fashion available for that. And that for me builds confidence in the person.
I want to come back home to Springfield. You've made some pretty impressive choices in your career about staying committed to Springfield, to the region, bringing shows back there, founding your company there. Why?
A lot of people think I'm crazy, to be honest with you. But I believe I owe it. This is a place I grew up in, born and raised. And I think I owe it here to at least try to make this area what it needs to be in fashion. I don't want to be the one to say I was from. I want to be the person that is living currently in Springfield, Massachusetts. I don't want to be that, you know, here's Justin Haynes from Springfield, Massachusetts. So I'm trying to make that a reality. Will it happen? I'm not sure. I do know that sooner or later, I'm probably going to grow past it. And it may not be what the city or the state wants to embrace.
So you said you want to help us be who we need to be in fashion. Who do we need to be in this region in fashion, and how do we get there?
We need to be in this region open to whatever it is that we see fashion is. A lot of people don't even know what the difference between fashion and style. Fashion is what we wear. Style is how we put it together. I think we need to embrace all levels of fashion. That means whatever it is, how you like it, you wear it. And I think that's what we lack here. And I think we can get there by embracing different levels of style and not just, you know, keeping to one level and not thinking that just one style is it. We have to be open to change.
How would we see, if we knew you really well, how would we look at your designs and say, I can see Justin's childhood in that design. I can see Springfield and his background and his community and the people who've loved him and cared for him in those designs?
You can see that because I use, believe it or not, I use a lot of my childhood growing up, sitcoms, TV shows, all of that. A lot of those are themed streamlines to each collection that I build. So you would see that a quick signature will be my patchwork. You know, there's going to be a patch on every garment. And that's going to automatically tell you that that's Justin Haynes. I don't even worry about the tag anymore because anybody can rip that out. I want you to see the tailorship in the garment. I want you to see that patch, and I also want you to see the level of work that I put into it.
So those little patches, I've noticed that in pictures of your fashion, you know, almost like the little patches we would put on jeans or parents would put on jeans for us as kids. Why those patches?
I wanted a signature. Like, I love patchwork. I've always loved patchwork, but there was never a patchwork on luxury clothing. There was never a patchwork on quite really streamlined tailored clothing. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted there to be a signature and a distinction in what patchwork can be. And that actually brought a level of color, and it brought a level of who I am. I'm one that thinks outside of the box. I wear what I want. I'm a free agent when it comes to fashion and style. And that was part of that. You can wear a suit and have a patch on it and still be okay.
So you made mention of, you know, we can see your childhood and your designs through the sitcoms that you enjoyed and that kind of thing. Tell me somebody you wanted to kind of be like when you grew up, when you were a kid.
It wasn't really a sitcom. It was actually a fashion designer, and that was Ben Sherman. Ben Sherman, I feel, even to this day, his brand has remained streamlined, and it has definitely been consistent in what they do. So Ben Sherman was one I looked up to. I looked up to his aesthetic. I looked up to him being real to who he was, never changing because the industry changed. And he was just an idol of mine.
And how does a kid in Springfield discover Ben Sherman's fashions?
You can discover Ben Sherman's fashion because he was always the guy to have that plaid patchwork, not patchwork, but that plaid inside. So he had different plaids, the ginghams, and all of that was always inside of his linings and linings of his shoes, the collars of his shirts. So that was always a Ben Sherman signature.
Is there someone you dream of wearing your designs who either you hope someday will or maybe already has?
There's three people, actually. We're leaning towards that. Nick Cannon was one, Erykah Badu, and Katy Perry. I was actually on the Kenny show last week, and his suit is being made now. So fingers crossed, all is well. He may be in my brand soon.
What colors are going into Nick Cannon's suit?
We're going to do a teal blue. Actually, it's already done. We're doing a teal blue with some black buttons, and we went with a burgundy crocodile.
And what is next for you? What's the next big project?
The next big project is whatever comes. I tell people all the time, I can't really streamline or really tell you what it is yet. There's so many things happening so fast that I'm taking it day by day. As it comes, I'm going with it.
And just briefly, in our last couple of seconds, any young designers locally you've got your eye on?
No, not yet. But I'm willing to always put a reaching hand out to anyone who is who needs the help or who wants the guidance. I'm here to help.
All right. That is Justin Haynes, Springfield resident and global fashion phenomenon with his brand Justin H. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
You can also catch a virtual showing of Justin's latest collection, Onyx, which he told us about, this Wednesday evening at runway360.com. Okay, we could not end the show today without acknowledging that it's Valentine's Day. Maybe you're hoping to spark a little romance with a gift of some stimulating chocolate. Not to thwart your plans, but scientific research shows it's not really an aphrodisiac. However, WBUR's Andrea Shea takes us back to a time when Americans consumed copious amounts of warm, decadent chocolate that might have had some sensual powers. And an advisory, this story does contain some mature content.
Early New Englanders were gaga for chocolate, but candy historian Susan Benjamin says they weren't eating it.
So you have people like the colonists and the big names out there, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and New England's own John Adams, busily drinking these wonderful frothy chocolate drinks with things like cinnamon and nutmeg and clove, all these wonderful spices that were themselves aphrodisiacs. Only the colonists didn't know it. Or maybe they did.
Benjamin says hot chocolate was an exotic and trendy import beginning in the 1600s. People drank it for nourishment and vitality. While chocolate itself isn't seen as an aphrodisiac, Benjamin points to a UCLA Medical Library list of spices, including nutmeg, ginger, and vanilla, that have erotic potential. She says for centuries they've been used around the world for seduction, but the colonists added them for flavor. Back then, chocolate was gritty and came in hard bricks or tablets.
It was unbelievably bitter and really required a great deal of work in what was then known as a chocolate pot.
So as I've been mixing it, the texture seems to be lightening up. It's getting nice and frothy on top.
Paula Marcoux, a culinary historian and archaeologist in Plymouth, was game to experiment with some old-school hot chocolate recipes.
The texture of chocolate was naturally very grainy and oily if you didn't do it properly. beating it together into a froth made it really palatable, delicious, and luxurious.
Sugar helped too. Making this concoction involved a few steps, starting with scraping the hard chocolate into a pile of bits.
You'd melt it in hot water, add hot milk to that, and then use a tool that they call a chocolate mill. It's really just an elaborate sort of stick.
Marcoux's husband fashioned a replica that she rubs rigorously between her hands. She says the elite weren't doing this work themselves. Servants fixed this high-calorie, high-fat drink for folks like the Washingtons, often in the morning.
They were choosing to have chocolate for breakfast instead of the normal beverage, which was beer or hard cider. So it's a very different feeling to the start of your day.
As for hot chocolate being an aphrodisiac, Marcoux suspects the rich caffeinated drink, spiced or not, gave the early New Englanders an energetic kick.
I think colonists were more liable to think about chocolate as for the bedroom than the spices, honestly. People were not Puritans even, were not as leery of sex as we like to think of them as. They, you know, thought that sex was great and that people should do everything they could to have sex as much as they possibly could, but with their spouses.
But some people condemned drinking chocolate for being too pleasurable, even sinful, according to Benjamin. Views shifted, though, and chocolate houses like those in Europe opened in Boston.
And the very first application was actually from two women, Dorothy Jones and Jane Barnard in 1670. And they wanted to have a chocolate house that would be for public entertainment, they called it, where they could sell coffee and also chocolate.
Chocolate went on to be all the rage. In the 1700s, revolutionists turned to it as a form of protest because it wasn't taxed by the British like the other ubiquitous hot beverage.
And so chocolate started to become a replacement for tea.
Jump to now, and Benjamin says people always ask how chocolate eventually transformed into a delectable candy.
Especially that we love and get during Valentine's Day. The answer is, in a word, industry.
Machines began producing glossy, melt-in-your-mouth chocolate like we find today. But Benjamin says if you really want to woo your lover this Valentine's Day, you could skip the heart-shaped box.
Go ahead, make some hot chocolate, mix in some of that good old cinnamon, and how about some clove? And now, wait and see what happens.
That report from WBUR's Andrea Shea. And that's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beeland. We had help today from Sarah Leeson and Francisca Monahan. Marquise Neal is our technical director, Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Great to be with you today. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you join us again tomorrow for another Radio Boston.